Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for Mays Nurses Club webinar. I'm delighted to introduce you to our speaker for today, Clinical Support Manager at Vets Now, Louise O'Dwyer. Thank you, Louise. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thanks very much, Sammy Jo. So in this afternoon's webinar, we're going to talk about critical care of geriatric patients. And if I'm honest, this is really a subject that's quite close to my heart because I currently have two dogs and one of them is a 14 or 15 year old collie. We're not entirely sure because he didn't come to me as a puppy. And my other dog is a 7 year old mastiff, which I keep telling myself is not actually that old yet, but at 7 years old, we know he's starting to get up there. So what do I mean when we talk about geriatrics? Well, geriatrics, you know, tend to be the category we put them into is dogs or cats equally that have reached 75 to 80% of their expected lifespan. In cats, that's generally 12 plus years, although I did see something on the internet the other day that said the world's oldest cat had died that was 30. So it makes my 18-year-old cat look like she's got plenty years left in her yet. For chihuahuas, that's probably 12 plus years, but for larger dogs and certainly those giant breed dogs, it can be as short as 5 to 7 years. So there is quite a variation in terms of the lifespan for these patients. And we know, you know, an awful lot has changed in veterinary medicine. Certainly from when I started nursing 15 years ago, you know, there's been a huge change. There's been a change in society in that we're now seeing clients that have increased expectations. You know, they have increased commitment themselves to the quality of care of their pets, and they expect that from us as veterinary professionals. And what that means for us is we're seeing a larger percentage of these patients that are living longer lives. We know that age is not a disease, and we know that really there's little correlation between physiologic and chronological age of a pet. So, you know, we don't necessarily get those age-related change being linear. You know, it's very much dependent on the species and the breed and that individual animal. But we do know that with age and increase in age, we get a progressive impairment of organ systems. We get the development of these age-related disease processes as well. And as I said, that variation, you know, really varies greatly between species, between breed, and between individual animals. We'll go back to my mastiff. You know, for seven, he still doesn't look too old. He's got a little bit of a grey beard going on, and he's got two grey whiskers. But overall, I think he's doing pretty well. And as I said, we want to really consider each animal individually. And I think, and I've not talked about this too much, we also really need to think about the owner as well. So we need to think about, you know, we often don't get talked about this, but how that animal's quality of life is affecting the owner's quality of life. That's going to vary massively between owners. You know, you have owners that are able to spend all day at home with their animals, but, you know, for, you know, if you look at us as nurses, if we can't take our animals to work and we have, you know, maybe incontinent geriatric patients, you know, that does make a difference to us. And I think we also need to bear that in mind. Yes, you know, as veterinary nurses, our main concern is going to be those patients, but, you know, thinking about the owner's quality of life, their well-being and all that should come into it as well. And I think as you get older and you do experience your animals going through those changes and those diseases as they become older, I think it helps us be able to, you know, have those conversations with owners. It allows us to be more empathetic about what they're going through and helping to make those really difficult decisions when it comes to, you know, euthanasia of those animals. So we're going to start off by looking at some of those changes that occur in these patients. The first thing we're going to look at the cardiovascular system. And the cardiovascular system accounts for many of those alterations that we see due to age-related changes or age-related disease. The symptoms can be absent, particularly if those patients have got gradual age-related deconditioning changes, or we can see very acute changes and sudden decompensation in some of those patients. And again, we get that big variation. With the vasculature of aging patients, what happens is it gradually loses elasticity over a period of time, and that occurs because of deposits of collagen, and that results in decreased vascular capacity and increased peripheral resistance to cardiac output. It makes it harder work for that heart to pump blood out and around the body, and that's going to increase work of the heart. What that means is it's more difficult for that patient to maintain that cardiac output. And what we also get is we get progressive hypertrophy, So, we get increased mass of that ventricle because of the harder work. And that's not good long term. This is going to have other knock-on effects. We also get increased oxygen demand to the myocardium. It's having to work harder. And we get increased blood pressure as well because of that vascular resistance, because it's harder work for that heart to pump blood around out against vasoconstriction, about against narrow blood vessels, and because of that hypertrophy as well of those the ventricles. So all of this kind of has knock-on long-term effects. We also, within the heart itself, the endocardium fibrosis, and that will decrease compliance. It decreases kind of elasticity, if you like, within the heart. We get valvular fibrosis as well, and we can get calcification. And this overall can lead to valvular rupture. We can also get myocardial fiber atrophy, so breakdown of the muscle fibers of the heart. That will decrease contractility, and that in turn is going to decrease cardiac output. We also can see alterations in heart rates and in heart rhythm, but that can arise because we, in elderly patients, we get pacemaker cells beginning to atrophy as well. And geriatric patients can also exhibit decreased baroreceptor activity because of slower recognition of hypertension. So everything's not working quite as it would do, and they're not able to compensate in the same way. And that's particularly relevant when these patients are under anesthesia. The body would have normal responses to when it detects that patient becoming hypertensive, that drop in blood pressure. And if that's going to happen more slowly, we need to be aware of that. And again, that has a big impact on picking the drugs that we're going to use for these patients under anesthesia. In terms of nursing care of these patients, and we'll talk more about this later on, we always want to be making sure we're assessing heart and pulse rate, palpating those pulses, looking at things like pillary fill time, mucous membrane colour, auscultating those heart sounds, and particularly when looking at anaesthesia and as kind of geriatric checks as well, checking on that patient's blood pressure. Under anaesthesia, we've either got Doppler or oscillometric or direct arterial catheter measurements. Most of us are not going to do direct arterial measurements. So for most of us, it's going to be Doppler or oscillometric techniques. And if we are concerned about arrhythmias and things like that, then Doppler is the most accurate in that kind of situation. But overall, it's about closely monitoring these patients. So we're picking up those changes as early as we possibly can do, being fairly proactive, and I don't really want to say aggressive about maintaining blood pressure, but it's something we want to really keep on top of. And a lot of these patients, if we do start to detect hypertension under anesthesia, we're going to give them boluses of fluids. That may not be quite so possible in those geriatric patients because there are going to be a high risk of fluid overloading. So we want to, as I said, really planning procedures in these patients. So we're really looking at using drugs that are going to have minimal changes on the cardiovascular system, so we're likely to see less issues overall in those patients. We also start to get some pulmonary changes as well. We get changes in the upper airway system and in the lower airway system. In the upper airway system, what we'll start to see is a decrease in airway protective mechanisms. So, decrease in laryngeal function, we get a decreased cough reflex, and we get increased pulmonary secretion viscosity. So, they have thicker, stickier fluids in their upper airway. And I know, one of the things that I've noticed in my older collie in terms of kind of that decreased laryngeal function is I can hear a change in his bark. His bark has become kind of hoarser, and I think he maybe has a little bit of laryngeal paralysis. But at 14 or 15, he's certainly not a good candidate for us going in, doing lots of investigations, potentially looking at doing surgery. We also get lower airway changes as well, in that we get a decreased efficiency of gas exchange. We start to get a wasting of the diaphragm and the intercostal muscles. And what that will do is it will decrease total lung expansion, it will decrease tidal volume within the thorax. Also, these patients have decreased numbers of alveoli and decreased elasticity as the alveoli. And as they start to lose that elasticity, they will snap closed earlier in the breathing cycle, and they will trap increased amounts there. And that has knock-on effects. We can start to see atelectasis, so complete collapse of some of the alveoli that are not going to contribute to respiratory function. But those alveoli will receive blood flow as well. And what this contributes to is what's called a ventilation perfusion mismatch, where you've got alveoli that are not getting oxygen to them, but they're still getting blood flow. And we can have some alveoli that are getting oxygen but have decreased blood flow. And that's generally more pronounced in patients that are under anaesthesia. So again, yes, it's not a webinar on anaesthesia, but these are things that we really want to consider when we do get these patients in for, procedures that are going to require an anaesthetic. What will start to happen, as I mentioned, is these alveoli losing elasticity. They snap closed earlier in the breathing cycle. They will trap increased amounts of air, and that increases what's called the closing volume of the alveoli, and that counts to somewhat of that decreased ventilation perfusion, that ventilation perfusion mismatch. Also, our geriatric patients will have a decreased or a lowered functional residual capacity. So your functional residual capacity is the little bit of air that's left within your lungs after normal expiration. If you all take a breath out, you can still breathe out a little bit more after that. And what that means is they will have decreased amounts of a partial pressure of oxygen within the bloodstream. And that's particularly important relating to anaesthesia and sedation. When these patients are sedated, we know we're going to have a decreased respiratory rate. We're going to have decreased effort, and we can start to have problems if they're not able to oxygenate themselves effectively. They also We have further issues as well that are compounded, particularly under anaesthesia, and we get profound muscle relaxation. We get very little active chest excursion, so we get, as we said, a decreased tidal volume. And these factors all can contribute to hypoxemia because they're going to lower that ventilation perfusion effectiveness. As we said, some bits of alveoli that are getting oxygen supply but no blood supply, and vice versa. So looking at these patients, some of them actually, when we're talking about anaesthesia, may benefit from intermittent positive pressure ventilation or mechanical ventilation. That wants to be done very carefully because these patients can also have kind of age-related changes that may not be that obvious. So things like pulmonary bullae, which are kind of like little air-filled blisters on the lungs, and they normally don't cause problems, but if we're using IPPV and we give these patients big tidal volumes, we give them a big breath, what that can do is sometimes pop some of these little bullae, and then you've got a patient with a closed pneumothorax and potentially a tension pneumothorax. So we need to make sure we don't cause barotrauma or volute trauma in these patients because we have, we're overdoing it with that IPPV. In some of these patients, if we are really struggling with oxygenation, and they are hypoxic, so we see them when they've got low SpO2 levels. What we can do is apply what we call positive end expiratory pressure, which will help promote gas exchange. And what that does is kind of holds the alveoli open longer at the end of a breath, so they never kind of really collapse down those alveoli, but always holding some of them open. And we can do this, we can buy little adapters, little valves that we add onto our anaesthetic circuits, or we can do that with some of the mechanical ventilators that are available on the market. Again, we're getting a little bit complex, but these are all things that we maybe need to consider. Do we need to do in these geriatric patients? So, in terms of nursing care of these patients, we want to carefully and regularly evaluate that patient's respiratory rate, their respiratory depth and pattern, and auscultate those lung sounds, both in conscious patients, in patients that are, within the hospital environment, as well as patients under anaesthesia, and particularly in patients post-operatively. Particularly if we have, ventilated that patient under anaesthesia, we want to try and identify if there's a problem. If that patient is hypoxic, we want to try and identify the potential cause. I've certainly seen patients, geriatric patients that have had procedures done under anaesthesia, so dentals, things like that, done the day before, that have presented to me within an emergency setting. And these patients have had pneumothoraxes because they've had barotrauma. That is something that ideally should have been picked up before that patient went home, because we're then seeing them much later on down the line when the owners notice that patient has issues. We can use pulse oximetry to assess are these patients able to oxygenate effectively, or we can do blood gas analysis, and particularly things like arterial blood gas analysis, as a really, the most sensitive indicator to say, are these patients able to actually oxygenate themselves adequately. Other kind of critical nursing procedures, if you do have these patients in that do have respiratory issues, and we are going to see, a high proportion of these geriatric patients that have things like pneumonia and aspiration pneumonia, we can look at humidifying supplemental oxygen. If these patients have got a cough, sometimes that will make loosen pulmonary secretions. So particularly if you use sodium chloride, a 0.9% sodium chloride solution for humidification, what that will do is break up the disulfide bonds in your mucus, make it a little bit more liquidy, and make it easier for those patients to expectorate to them to cough out. We want to think about positioning of these patients when they're in a hospital environment. So wherever possible, we will keep that patient in sternal recumbency. If that not possible, then we want to make sure we turn them ideally every 2 hours, at a minimum every 4 hours. We want to do coupage of that patient's upper side before we turn them, and then we'll do coupage of the opposite side. And again, that's going to assist with, expectoration, coughing up of those secretions. And we can do some coupage on them when they're up and around in the clinic. Little things like, if we are able to do so, getting those patients up and walking around, depending obviously on that patient's underlying condition, but that's going to, help in terms of protecting airway tissues. Those patients are going to take bigger, better breaths in when they're walking around. It helps protect from that lung atelectasis, so lung atelectasis being that collapse down of those lower lung lobes. We know it's particularly an issue under anaesthesia, and that's one of the things where it's really important to monitor these patients carefully during recovery from anaesthesia, in all body systems, but particularly that respiratory system. But we can also see in recumbent patients that are lied in lateral recumbency for long periods of time. And as we said, just that walking around will help get those patients to cough a little bit more. Not that I'm suggesting you're all geriatrics, but we've probably all experienced this a little bit when you have a really bad cough or a flu or something like that. And first thing in the morning, when you get up and start moving around, you cough more at that point. That's because during the night, you've not taken normal breaths in and out. And so you've not cleared all that mucus from your airways. And that's what starts to happen in the morning. Looking at the abdominal organs, we have certainly, as they get older, we get decreased regional blood flow to those abdominal organs. We can see that because they have decreased cardiac output. They have that increased vascular resistance as well, making it hard work to pump blood out. We know the pancreas, as those patients get older, seems to be much more sensitive to insults from extreme diet changes or other illnesses. And we know we probably have a higher proportion of geriatric patients coming into the clinic that do have pancreatitis. We get a little bit of associated with individual breeds as well. We know things like cocker spaniels are much more, have a higher predisposition to developing pancreatitis. Other instances of pancreatitis can occur from inflammatory or infectious or traumatic illnesses as well. And we can also see issues in terms of the pancreas in that patients may have a decrease in production of pancreatic enzymes. So exocrine pancreatic insufficiency can also occur in geriatric patients. And sometimes they can get this, particularly after bouts of pancreatitis as well. We start to get GI tract changes. Elderly patients are less able to tolerate periods of inappetence. We can see less efficient GI tracts that change over a period of time. They have decreased esophageal motility. They have decreased absorption capabilities. And as I said, they're much more sensitive overall. They're much more sensitive to dietary changes as well. The less tolerant of those periods of inappetence, and despite these patients generally having lower exercise levels and overall having a reduced metabolism, we know these patients, are likely to not eat quite as much, but certainly for any geriatric patient, not wanting to eat certainly is a big cause of concern. We need to look at addressing it appropriately, even in those obese patients that we can look at and sometimes think, oh, well, they could do with losing a few pounds. We still want to, get on top of it sooner rather than later. For me, the longest period of time a patient will go without food for or without adequate food for is 3 days within a hospital environment. We want to start thinking, what can we do to get nutrition into that patient? Because we know if they don't eat, things are going to start to cascade and get worse much more rapidly. So when we're looking at the GI tract and we're looking at feeding these patients, we want to consider their individual requirements according to their body weight, according to their actual age, according to their disease. Overall, we'd look at giving these patients a much more highly digestible diet, and that's going to be necessarily because digestion is generally less efficient in these older patients because they've got decreased liver function, because we said they've got that GI decreased GI absorption, decreased GI motility. Also, bear in mind, often these patients will have a decreased thirst response as well, so we need to keep on top of that and just make sure they are an adequate fluid intake. As I said, for me, the longest period of time a patient would go for any patient would be 3 days. So in some of these geriatrics, we may want to consider placing nasogastric tubes, and that's going to give us several benefits. It's going to allow us to remove excess gastric fluid. So particularly that could be useful in those patients that are nauseous and vomiting. It's going to help decrease incidence of gastric reflux. Again, we want to avoid that. And particularly if these patients are going to undergo anaesthesia, sometimes I'll do this, in those foreign body patients, but particularly in geriatrics, we can suction out the contents of their stomach. It's going to decrease the risk of reflux, regurgitation and vomiting. And then aspirating those contents because, as we said, they have that decreased laryngeal function. They're not going to have those protective airway mechanisms. So, if we are aware that's an issue, consider placing nasogastric tubes. And the obvious things is that it will ha allow us to get nutrition into these patients sooner rather than later. And as I said, for me, 3 days is the longest period I will go, ideally go for in these patients, and I'll start discussing with vets how we can look at getting some nutrition into these animals sooner rather than later. We're going to get changes in the renal system, so certainly renal insufficiency or renal disease is one of the common conditions that are going to affect geriatric patients. They get a loss of cortical mass, so they get a decrease in kidney size and kidney weight. They have decreased numbers of functioning glomeruli. They have decreased size of renal tubules. They have an increase in tissue fibrosis. And these are all common things that we'll find in aging pets to varying degrees again. The kidney distal tubules also become less responsive to the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, and that decreases that patient's ability to conserve sodium and water. And we want to think about that in relation to the fact that I've just mentioned these patients are not are less likely to drink the amounts that they need to drink. So we need to keep a close eye on that as well, and making sure they are getting adequate fluid intake, and think about how we're going to address that if we think, that's an issue for that patient. We get morphological changes. So as we said, that and those morphological changes occur because of decreasing renal blood flow, decreasing glomerular filtration rates, that patient's decreased ability to concentrate urine. So they're less tolerant of a decrease in body water status. So we need to keep a close eye on that. And as I say, think about addressing it sooner than rather than later if we do think that it's an issue in that patient. So overall, the increased risk of fluid deficit. Add into that, patients may actually not be able to get up and get around and actually drink adequate amounts themselves. So for me, I make sure that we are physically taking fluids to those patients on a regular basis. Bear that in mind. If they can't get around, we're going to have to do everything for them that they can't do themselves. Normal voluntary fluid intake in patients is around 40 mils per kilo per day in dogs, 20 mils per kilo per day in cats. So I'll bear that in mind. And quite often, what I will do is I'll measure a volume out, check how much that patient is drinking, and record that on that patient's hospital sheet so we know, do we need to look at other ways of getting on top of that patient's fluids. We also want to really think about disease processes or the surgery that these patients have had. If they've got diseases that are going to make them, have, exaggerated fluid losses, if they're anorexic, if they've got vomiting, diarrhea, if they had third space in the fluids, or we're doing surgery so they're not likely to drink for a period of time before and afterwards. We really want to keep a close eye on things. So as you said, carefully monitoring their requirements, observe them for signs of hypovolemia as well. We want to protect against hypovolemia, so we're doing something before it happens. And also, we want to protect against renal ischemic episodes. That can happen if these patients become very dehydrated and hypovolemic. And as I said, if they're undergoing surgery or anesthesia for any reason, you know, one, they're not likely to be drinking for a period of time prior to surgery and probably afterwards. Under anesthesia, they're going to have a, you know, decreased renal perfusion. We want to try and avoid it as much as we can. As I said, we're going to closely monitor these patients' blood pressure, but it is an issue. We want to think about increasing their fluid replacements, both pre, intra, and post operatively. So, assessing that patient's overall volume status, making sure we're aware of what that patient's renal function is before we go into surgery. We want to give them fluid therapy, but as I said, we need to be very cautious. You know, we'd normally bolus in fluids in normal, healthy, you know, young or adult patients. We're not able to do that to the same extent in our geriatrics. You know, they may have cardiac disease, they may have other disease processes that contraindicate fluid therapy entirely. So these are the ones where I would maybe consider placing a central line into them. That's going to allow us to measure central venous pressure, and that's going to give us a better overall assessment of that patient's volume status. I know that not every practice is going to be able to do that, but if these are very critical patients, that may be the only way of being able to do that really, you know, appropriately. But certainly monitoring their hydration status, avoiding them becoming dehydrated, and certainly doing something before they get to the point where they're actually hypovolemic. So as I mentioned, I will make sure we're taking water to these patients. I'll offer fluids or encourage these patients to drink every 2 hours. And sometimes we can even think about adding, you know, additives into that patient's fluids. That's just going to encourage them to drink a little bit more. So sometimes I'll add in a little bit of, you know, stock, as long as it's not too salty, because we don't want to add too much sodium, or even adding something like baby food, just to encourage that patient to drink a little bit more. Sometimes just splashing some water around their lips and onto their tongue can help as well. I'll measure those fluids in and out, so keeping an eye on urination as well, every 4 hours. If they're on fluid therapy, I'm going to check they're on the correct fluid type, the additives are appropriate, that they haven't expired. You know, bearing in mind, we can't just leave that patient on a bag of fluids with additives in for, you know, you know, however long it takes for that bag to run out. You know, making sure, you know, these are not light-sensitive drugs, and thinking, do we need to change them every 24 hours, every 12 hours, every 6 hours? For patients that are on IV fluids, as I said, we'll measure their total fluids in and out every 4 hours. You know, making sure they're on appropriate fluid therapy rates, even if it's just IV maintenance. Other things that we can do is check their specific gravity. If we are taking them out to urinate, we can do a free catch urine sample. I'll monitor the urine output as well, as we said, for part of that ins and outs. We can either do that via free catch, by weighing that bedding going in and coming out again. If we've got indwelling catheters, we can weigh that amount of urination in that as well. And sometimes what I can try and do is weigh that patient before they go out to urinate, and when they come back in again, and we know a mill of urine is going to weigh about 1 gram. I'll check that patient's urine specific gravity as well, and that gives us some idea on that patient's kidneys concentrating ability. For anything less than 10/20 in a dog and 10/30 in a cat, that would indicate for me an insufficiency, so they're not able to concentrate urine appropriately. So these are kind of all the trigger points for me when I'd go and discuss that with a vet and raise my concerns. In terms of the hepatic system, we get an overall decrease in liver mass as those patients get older. We're going to get a decrease in liver function, and that's going to have an impact on the drugs that we're given. They're going to have decreased drug clearance, and what that can mean is we've got an increase in plasma half-life of drugs. So those drugs that are dependent on hepatic metabolism and excretion are going to have a longer lasting effect. These patients, if they do have altered liver function, are going to have a predisposition to hypoglycemia because they have that altered gluconeogenesis. So we want to think, is that likely to be an issue, keeping an eye on glucose levels? That's particularly important if patients are not eating or we're starving them for things like anaesthesia. For those geriatric patients, what I'll generally try and do is get them as high up on that ops list, so for the day, so like one of the first patients on that ops list. Obviously, we've got to tie them in with other patients coming in for specific procedures, and I know, our clean procedures like orthopedics are going to be want to be high on that list as well. But what I want to do is try and starve them for short periods and get them back eating as soon as possible after surgery as well. Bear in mind that, again, related to decreased hepatic function, we can have a decreased production of proteins, particularly the ones that are involved in the clotting cascade. So with those geriatrics, we want to be careful about venipuncture techniques. If we have any concerns at all, or just as a kind of a geriatric screening profile, maybe looking at measuring clotting times and doing things like platelet counts that we can do manually and fairly cheaply within practice as well. And as I said, don't forget we have that altered metabolism and or redistribution of drugs around the body. So when we're looking at particularly our anesthetics and our analgesics, we want to dose to effect, start off low dose, particularly with things like analgesics, and top up as we think that patient requires them. In terms of the urinary system, as we mentioned already with the kidneys, we've got varying degrees of renal compromise that are likely in these geriatric patients. They're likely to be PU, polyuric, polydipsic to a varying degree. We want to consider those alterations to the urinary system in regards to the bedding. So ideally, making sure people are aware of these patients if they are incontinent, changing bedding quickly, having bedding that's going to wick urine away, so we're avoiding things like urine scald. If we are really concerned, clipping hair around the genital area, the perineum, just to try and keep these patients cleaner and drier. And we can use things like barrier sprays or cream to try and prevent urine scalding. You also may want to make sure if these patients can get up and out, that we're giving them plenty opportunities to urinate. They're not likely to be able to hold the urine as long as adult patients are, and particularly if they're on intravenous fluids as well. We may need to give them assistance, dogs if we're taking them outside to make sure they can squat or cot their legs. So looking at harnesses and slings and things like that. With cats, we want to make sure we have low litter trays that they can get into, and thinking about the type of litter that animal normally uses. So again, with geriatrics, speaking to owners, making sure we know what's normal for those patients is really, really important. As mentioned, these patients may well have some degree of urinary incontinence. That's just because they can start to get a urethral sphincter incompetence, and that can be related to aging, and it can due to be a lack of estrogen. It can be because they get anatomical changes, so we can get abnormal positioning or morphology of the bladder, tumors, stones. It can be because they've got hernias and we can get retroflexion of the bladder into those. It can be because those patients are overweight. It can also be related to we can get prostatic disease changes, and we can get neurogenic changes as well. So we want to think, are these factors at play in these patients? So as I said, we want to make sure we take these patients outside more frequently so they do have that opportunity to urinate. Make sure we use wicker bedding that's going to wick that fluid away. So particularly things like vet beds, or using absorbent pads. If these patients are recumbent and they're likely to be recumbent for periods of time, considering is it worth placing a urinary catheter so we avoid that issue. And also thinking about if we are placing catheters, we want to make sure we're doing that aseptically. These patients have got decreased immune function, so they're likely to be much higher risk of developing ascending bladder urinary tract infections as well. We get alterations in that musculoskeletal system as well, and they get alterations because of aging. So we get changes in elasticity, blood flow, and decreased muscle mass overall within these patients. The joints are going to be less flexible. We're going to start to get degeneration. We get osteoarthritis, all those different types of things, and they're going to be much more common in those older patients. So if we do have these patients in, we can start to think about, can we look at doing physiotherapy techniques? Can we do, application of heat or cold? Particularly if these patients have had surgical procedures, and particularly if they're recumbent, using things like massage techniques and passive range of motion exercises. If they're not able to get up and move around, they're still going to start to get really stiff very quickly, and that's going to make it much more difficult to get these patients up and back on their feet and moving around. If they are immobile for long periods of time, they're going to get further atrophy of those muscles, and that's going to occur much more rapidly in these geriatric patients. So Early physiotherapy, trying to maintain that muscle mass and that range of movement they've patients have got is very, very important because when they do get up and get moving, they're going to be much more painful. Other things that we want to make sure people think about is using really gentle restraint techniques. If these patients have got, particularly, osteoarthritis, degenerative joint disease, restraining them, even for things like placing intravenous catheters, is going to be much, much more painful. So just make sure people bear that in mind. I'm thinking about from a bedding point of view, and I'll mention this later on, making sure we're really padding those patients, make sure they're in comfortable positions, avoiding putting these patients, if they are recumbent, into positions they wouldn't be able to normally get themselves into and forcing them into that position. Also, making sure we avoid these patients developing decubital ulcers. So if they are, they've got decreased blood flow to their skin already because they're older, a lot of the time these patients can be overweight. That's going to predispose them to developing decubital ulcers. Combined with that, the fact they can't move around, combined with that fact that they may be incontinent, and all of this added together will make these patients much higher risk of getting that ulceration. So we want to keep a close eye on it, checking over, points and bony prominences to make sure those pressure sores aren't starting to develop. Things that we can do to kind of avoid these changes happening, avoid things starting to go wrong. Short assisted walks, if they're smaller patients, we can maybe carry them outside, but using slings and harnesses and things like that just to be able to get these patients up, around, keeping them mobile. As I said, regular auscultation of the heart and the thorax. If you do notice any respiratory or cardiac changes, making sure that intolerance is not new or it's not a worsening of a pre-existing problem. If you've got any concerns, feeding those concerns back to the vets. And I've mentioned already making sure that that patient's nutritional needs are provided as well. So I think I've mentioned all this, but I'm going to talk about it on the next slide. Even if these patients haven't got pre-existing joint disease, they, are likely to have restricted movement. They're not going to tolerate that as well. So frequent walks. A nice warm environment, as I said, application of heat and cold. So a hot water bottle or warm towels over their hips and their joints for 5 to 10 minutes, and that's going to increase blood flow to that area. It'll decrease pain, help keep those patients more mobile. Bearing that in mind, make sure that we're really careful about doing this. We don't want to burn or overheat the patient, and that can happen very, very easily. So for the same reasons, they'd like to develop pressure sores or decubital ulcers, that decreased blood flow to the skin, less fat, so less padding. They can equally get heat burns very easily. And as I said, using harnesses and slings to help get them mobile, help get them moving around a little bit more easily. Looking on that kind of same sort of thread, these patients are likely to have chronic pain from that joint disease, from arthritis, or because of other disease processes. We want to make sure we question those owners, and hopefully the vets will have done this, but as nurses, I think we're part of this process, checking that they're not on any specific long-term pain relief. If you do have concerns that these patients are having difficulty getting around because of maybe something new that's added in or just from being lined recumbent in their kennels, discussing with the vets, is there any medications that we can look to adding in that may help them? Chondroprotectants, there's not a huge amount of evidence that they're going to make a difference, particularly in chronic osteoarthritis, but I still put my animals onto them, just in case there is a potential benefit. Are these patients on non-steroidals, making sure they're getting appropriate doses, making sure we're not getting missed doses, or are these things that we can add in? Are opioids appropriate? I'm a big fan of paracetamol. I think, there is very little evidence about its efficacy in veterinary patients. But if the patients do have any renal issues, then using paracetamol may be a useful alternative or something that we can add in along with a non-steroidal. Paracetamol isn't technically a non-steroidal, so it's something we can potentially use on side alongside. And again, I know as nurses we can't diagnose and prescribe, but we can maybe, I think we should be in part of that process of discussing this patient's treatment plans with the vets. And sometimes, most vets will say, great idea, things like you're suggesting to add in to make life a little bit easier for these patients. Other stuff we can think about adding in, gabapentin, particularly if we think there's any neurological aspect to it. And other drugs like amantadine are beginning to be used more frequently as add-in drugs, particularly in those old patients with really bad osteoarthritis. Sometimes these drugs can make a big difference to those patients' comfort levels and make a big difference to their quality of life as well. So as I said, frequent shortcuts free for those chronic pain patients, short, frequent walks, making sure they're in cages that are easy to get in and out of. We don't have to jump in or out of them. Good, well padded, thick, comfortable bedding, making sure the medications are as planned and on their hospital records. And as I said, nurses and vets planning procedures together as well. You know, preempting, you know, with sedation or anaesthetics, if we know these patients are going to have surgical procedures to make sure they've got appropriate analgesia. And as I've mentioned, really being careful and considering that they're geriatrics when we're handling and placing these patients, you know, in positions and kennels, depending on the specific conditions they have. I know this is something I didn't always think about, and even with my, and sometimes I think about it more so when I've experienced it with my old dogs now. You know, I can remember taking some x-rays of my old collie, him being frog-legged because I wanted him in sternal recumbency during recovery, and then afterwards he was so incredibly painful to the point of being aggressive because I'd forced his hips into an abnormal position and he was very painful post-operatively. All these little learning things make us think about differently about the way we treat our patients. So, you know, everything's a learning process. We mentioned these patients are not going to have normal immune function. Aging's associated with a decline in functional competence of the immune system. Sometimes it's termed immunosenescence. And this is a multifactorial complex of changes that occur in the immune system of elderly individual patients. And it predisposes them to increased morbidity, increased mortality because of infection and age-related pathology. So we know these patients, you know, we can get decreased wound healing, we've got a decreased incidence of post-operative wound infections, you know, all these different things come into play in senior patients. You know, you can combine that, you know, looking at wound healing with these tape patients generally have, you know, may have decreased, you know, altered nutritional requirements. They may not be getting in adequate amounts of protein and things like that, and making sure these patients are on an appropriate diet can sometimes be very difficult if they've got specific disease processes that mean they have to be on a specific diet. So things become quite complicated when it comes to nutrition in these geriatric patients. You know, diseases can alter immune function. You know, Cushing's disease, diabetes mellitus, hyperproteinemia, you know, can all affect wound healing. So we want to be mindful of that when they've got, you know, having surgical procedures, when they've got invasive procedures, when they've got catheters, drains, things like that, and when we're doing nursing care procedures in those patients, full stop. The nervous system is also a thing that's going to change in terms of get age-related changes with geriatric patients. We get a number of neurological diseases that occur primarily or exclusively in older dogs and cats. So the most common one we think about is age-related degenerative brain disease. You know, this is where we basically start to get abnormal behavioral activity because of progressive deterioration of sensory integration and motor capabilities. So these patients, you know, we can often see them have been more sleeping more than normal, having unnatural drowsiness. They can have alterations in sleep-wake cycles. They can have that appropriate elimination. It's not necessarily associated with incompetence. And we think about all that going on. You know, we think about, you know, older humans, we expect that to be normal. I think sometimes we can forget that in our patients. And then we put them into the hospital environment where, you know, they can sometimes cope with things at home because it's their normal, safe environment. We change them, put them in a hospital environment. They can become easily confused. They can become more distressed when we take them away from that familiar environment. They can sometimes become aggressive as well. So I think as nurses, it's really important that we talk to owners, you know what's a normal routine for that animal and trying to maintain that as much as we possibly can do. Also, what I will do is bear in the back of my mind that for some of these patients, you know, we can also get changes that are associated with, you know, brain tumors, you know, things like that. So all that we want to bear in the back of the mind, you know, everything we're talking about today, we want to consider when we're looking at hospitalization, we're looking at handling, we're looking at monitoring of these patients and looking at what procedures we're going to do. So I think overall, geriatric patients tend to have it a little bit tougher in terms of coming in and being hospitalized in our in our clinics. We're going to get changes in that patient's skin and coat. They have increased sebum production, so it can start to lose its gloss, it can look greasier, it can accumulate dirt more quickly, they can get a bit smellier. We know older patients tend to be a little bit smellier, so we might look about, grooming them, cleaning them. When we're looking at grooming and things like that, bear in mind that if they've got osteoarthritis, it's going to be more painful. That decreased muscle mass can make grooming much more uncomfortable for those patients. And I do think as well they could become less tolerant of it. I know my old collie kind of doesn't like being groomed as much as he used to, but regular grooming, nice soft bristle brush, or using a massage and kind of grooming type tool, or kind of these rubbery things, can sometimes make that patient little feel a little bit better. It's the opportunity to spend quality time with them. It can help decrease anxiety. It can give them a feeling of well-being. And it's got beneficial effects, and it encourages surface blood flow circulation, and it gives us that chance to examine the coat and the skin. We can give them a little bit of a face wash, clean their eye discharges, their nose discharges with some damp cotton wool. And as I said, it gives us that chance to have some social interaction and some mental stimulation for those patients too. The other thing to bear in mind is keep an eye on the length of claws as well, because they can, obviously get very overlong in those patients if they're not walking in the same way they used to. In terms of appetite, these patients generally are going to be more fussy in terms of what they eat. Again, normal things that we want to speak to the owners about and question them about. Make sure we're talking about their normal diet, normal quantity, the normal frequency. Is there anything they'd like or they do like? Make sure we're logging that on that patient's clinical records or the hospital sheets. They're likely to have decreased ability to smell and taste those foods. So maybe if we are struggling with getting them to eat, look at things like highly aromatic diets, warming those foods up to body temperature. They're less likely to be able to eat normal volumes as well, so small frequent meals are much likely to be more appealing to those geriatric patients. And also consider, is there a reason why they're not able to eat? Have they got, periodontitis? Have they got gingivitis? Can you see any signs of ulceration or damaged teeth that may be causing problems? And sometimes what I like to do is, speak to the owners and even get them to bring that animal's normal bowls and things like that in, and it can just all help that animal a little bit more to feel at home in that hospital environment and get them eating more without having to go to putting things like feeding tubes into those patients, which we want to try and avoid doing wherever we can. If these patients are underweight, we want to think about providing, as we said, small regular meals to try and reduce fluctuations in glucose, which I know we're likely to be more prevalent as they get older. As I said, highly palatable foods that are high in protein, appropriate levels of protein, I should add, moderate levels of fat. If they are underweight, weighing that patient at least once a day, if not twice daily, is particularly important. Making sure we know exactly how much they've eaten, because sometimes it's very easy to assume that a patient's eating a decent amount when they're not actually. So I like to weigh the food, work out how many calories they're actually taking in. So weigh it as it goes in and afterwards, so we know the number of calories they're consuming. And as I said, thinking early on about placing feeding tubes in those patients where we are concerned they're not eating adequate amounts. Overweight patients, I think we do, when they are in hospitals for long periods of time, have a tendency to overfeed them. Again, speaking to the owners, making sure if those patients are already on a calorie restricted diet, then we continue in that hospital environment. Having specific nutrition plans in place as well. Bearing in mind, it can be dangerous for these patients to lose large quantities of weight quickly, particularly in those fat cats. Things like hepatic lipidosis is a major risk as well. So we want to question owners, specific food, specific volume. If we don't have that diet in, say that to the owner, see if they can bring some of that in. And that's going to help reduce stress for that patient, reduce dietary indiscretion as well. We want to try and avoid giving these patients treats in the hospital environment. They're generally high in salt and in fat, and we want to try and avoid low sodium diets in these patients. So for those overweight patients, we'll generally go with small, frequent meals of high protein, complex carbohydrate diets, unless something else is indicated. Many of those overweight patients may be well be diabetic and may be underdiagnosed diabetic, so think about keeping an eye on those glucose levels in those patients as well. Other issues we can have is thermoregulatory problems. Thermoregulatory mechanisms are controlled by the hypothalamus, and that initiates vasomotor or metabolic changes to maintain core body temperature within a normal range, despite, varying environmental temperatures. Our aging patients are going to have decreased thermoregulatory capacity, so they may be hotter, they may be more colder. They may, depends very much on the season. So we want to regularly monitor that patient's body, make sure they're in an appropriate environmental temperature, because again, they don't have normal brain function, so they can have altered that altered capacity to maintain their body within that normal range. So just keep that in the back of our minds as well. That's particularly important, and we'll mention this when we're looking at anesthesia of those patients too. In terms of mentation, we are going to have some degree of sensory impairment. We're going to have some degree of visual or auditory impairment is likely to be present in older patients, where some of them can actually may be able to function quite normally in protective environments like at home. As I said, we put them into unfamiliar environments like the veterinary practice. They can become nervous, they can be confused, they can even become aggressive. So we want to again question owners about normal behavior at home and normal routine at home, and try and do that within the practice as much as is possible. We know we're going to get a decline in cognitive function. We're going to get a decline in perception, awareness, learning, memory, decision making. So they're not able to take in that normal information about their environment. They're not able to retain that kind of learnt behavior they've already had, and that's what accounts for some of those kind of senility changes that we can see in these patients. We can see in them as being, less mentally alert, and people can interpret them by that as being stubborn or as being withdrawn. So again, really thinking about mentation is hugely important in these patients, and particularly when they're taken out of that home environment. We want to make sure they get adequate amounts of rest, particularly if you're working in busy 24-hour clinics, make sure they have a night time. I know sometimes it's a bit of a pain, but speaking to owners, if they want to bring them in, bringing in a familiar blanket or bed, or what I'll sometimes say is even bringing in a t-shirt or something like that, that the owner isn't worried about getting back, because we all know losing beds and things like that can be an issue in veterinary practices. But sometimes those familiar smells at home from home can be really comforting for these patients. Also consider the use of synthetic pheromones, whether they're feline, things like Feelyway, or the DAP diffusers for dogs. They can just, the environmental use of these for pheromone therapy can improve the demeanor, the appetite, and that patient's ability to adapt to stresses within that strange environment. So consider their use within the hospital setting as well. In terms of therapeutic agents, we've touched on this already. As these patients get older, there's going to be important interrelationships between the loss of physiological reserves because of those aging changes, because of previous trauma or disease process that that patient may have. And that's going to alter the way that and the effects of those drugs that we're administering to these patients. So age-related changes that are going to affect drugs we're given include that reduction in total body water, reduction in lean body mass, generally an increase in body fat, and that's going to increase the concentration of drugs within body fluids. It's going to increase the concentration and prolong elimination of drugs, particularly fat-soluble drugs as well. They have, quite often reduce liver mass, reduce hepatic blood flow. What that will do is reduce what's called a first pass metabolism, the amount of drug that's taken out by the liver when it passes through. It's going to decrease the rate of biotransformation. And what overall that's going to happen is we're going to get prolonged activity of these drugs. We can start to get accumulation of these drugs within the body. Also, if patients have got low albumin levels, we can have an increased fraction of protein-bound drugs within the blood. So that's particularly our anesthetic agents are all highly protein-bound. What that means is that there's an increased amount of that free drug within the body to exert a greater effect. That's why, really dosing to effect is vitally important on these patients. We can easily overdose them if we're not careful. They also have those changes to the kidneys. They get a loss of functional reserve, loss of functional nephrons, reduced glomerular filtration rate, so it's going to reduce drug elimination rates, prolonged effects, as we said, result in accumulation. So think about that, bear in the back of mind the possibility of increased drug adverse drug reactions. If you do see anything abnormal in these patients, report it back to the vets. As I mentioned, evaluate each patient individually. Consider their body weight, their body condition score, the drugs that we're giving to these patients. And particularly for things like anesthesia, we want to select the safest therapeutic agents, bearing in mind concurrent disease, considering the effects of polypharmacy as well. So thinking already these drugs these patients may be on, likely to interact with each other, and as I said, bear in the back of mind the possibility of drug reactions as well. We want to make sure we know from the owners what drugs these patients are already on or at home, so get details regarding the timing, the dosages, the frequency. Also, make sure owners are giving the dosages of what they're supposed to be given as well. And as I said, bearing the back in mind some things like chondroitin, some of the fish oils can interfere with some of the prescription medication that these patients are already on. So that's why, really careful questioning of whether the owners put their dogs onto anything themselves is vitally important, because we know owners will go to health food shops and buy things that are, supplements for humans and give them to their patients without thinking about the effects that they can have on the body. So specific questioning about things like, are they on glucosamine, chondroitin, things like that, just to make sure we're thinking about drug interactions as well. And from a nursing point of view, TLC is hugely important. As I mentioned, some of this, we get that those changes in brain function, cognitive function. These patients can be very frightened, they can be very confused. It's easy to, get very fed up with those barking senile geriatric dogs. But remember, some of that may well be because they're confused, they're in a different environment. We've not even gone there with, sight changes and things like that. These patients probably can't see. We know that 80% of all our geriatric patients are going to have some degenerative changes to their eyes. They're not going to be able to see normally, and that can have a big impact on them as well. They're going to be less able to eat and drink and toilet. So these patients have a self-care deficit, and what that means is we're going to have to do them for them things that they can't do for themselves. So they're not going to be able to self-groom, potentially clean themselves up or toilet, or even get up and go outside. So I've talked about these things already, but just making sure nurses are thinking about that within the whole of the hospital and not getting fed up with those geriatric patients because they're barking lots and, upsetting the other patients. Maybe you just need to go and sit and spend a little bit more time with them, give them that little bit extra TLC. I'm not going to talk about anesthesia hugely in these patients, but if we do have patients coming in for procedures, make sure we get a thorough history. As I said, checking things like, drugs that these patients are on, drugs that the owners are maybe prescribing for their patients. Talking to owners about, appropriate blood profiles that we want to get, certainly PCV, total protein, specific gravity, blood glucose, maybe things like clotting times. If we're not doing a full biochemistry, look at checking renal function and potentially hepatic function. So selecting specific tests that we know are going to be very useful and gives us as much information as we can get together about these patients. If we have the capability, even looking at things like blood gas analysis. For me, I like to do a thorough major body system examination of that patient myself. If they're coming for procedures, then we're going to have to anaesthetize them, and as a nurse, I'm going to be doing the anaesthetic, so I know baseline parameters in these patients. I've done that throughout thoracic auscultation, that cardiac auscultation. I know if there's any problems that I've picked up preoperatively, because we can start to get things going wrong under anaesthesia. So we want to know, is that an anaesthetic related issue or was it already there beforehand? Preoperatively, we're likely to have to, if we're going to anaesthetize that patient, fast for a period of time. I'll discuss with the vets, but the longest period of time in geriatrics I'm going to starve them for preoperatively is going to be 6 hours, sometimes not that long in geriatric patients, and I never withhold water. They have water up until the time they're pre-medded. As I said, I try and get them on as one of the first procedures of the day as early as possible. I'll chat with the vets about what anaesthetic plan they're going to use, think about problems that patient has, drugs that are maybe going to have less cardiovascular effects. support the cardiovascular system with IV fluids, but careful, rational use. We know we've really changed from that 10 mils per kilo per hour approach to intravenous fluids under anaesthesia to a 5 mil per kilo in dogs, 3 mils per kilo in cats. Making sure we have analgesia as part of that patient's pre-med, thinking are non-steroidals appropriate for these patients? They may well not be in some of the geriatric patients if they've got kidney or hepatic disease. For the smaller patients, particularly, and all for geriatrics, I think about warming those patients from the moment they have a pre-med. They're going to start to get cold, they're not moving around as normal. And pre-oxygenating them before induction is also hugely important as well. They've got that decreased functional residual capacity, they're not going to tolerate periods of apnea, they're going to become hypoxic much more quickly. I mentioned this when I talked about positioning in kennels, but remember patient comfort during surgery. Think about really positioning them very carefully. Frog-like positions. Think about, putting some pads underneath their hind limbs to support them so they're not completely frog-legged and then going to be more uncomfortable post-operatively. Post-op, comfortable bed, very well padded, nice and warm. If they do have a prolonged recovery, it's because they've got decreased drug metabolism. They've maybe got hepatic or kidney issues. What I'll commonly do is express these patients' bladder before recovery as well, if that's appropriate. So, we don't have to get them up. We know they're going to take longer to come round. So we want to try and avoid them urinating their bed and the problem we can get associated with that. And if they're undergoing specific procedures and we think it's appropriate or relevant, discussing with the vets and placing feeding tubes, esophagostomy tubes, gastrostomy tubes, if they think these patients are likely to have periods of anorexia related to the procedures they've had done post-operatively. Also, post-op, remember these patients have got sensory deficits, and that's going to increase their anxiety levels coming round in that, they don't know where they are, they've had an anaesthetic, they can be very confused, they may be deaf, they may have altered sight as well. So keep that in the back of your mind and remember that we can get behavioural changes associated with that. As I said, right from the moment we pre-med these patients, we want to think about analgesia, but I said making sure we're using non-steroidals in co with caution, particularly on those patients that we're concerned about, renal issues and GI issues as well. So that was a bit of a whistle stop tour. It was only an hour long, so I feel like I've sped all the way through that. Hopefully that's useful. Hopefully it's given you some more things to think about in terms of having these patients in your hospital environment. As I said, I think having older dogs myself has really made me think about this more because I see those changes that happen and I know how upset my own dogs will be being in that, different environments, being away from me because they do get to spend, a huge part of their proportion of their day with me, and I'm used to their little, their little quirks, what they like, what they don't like. So questioning owners and making sure you get an understanding. And I know it's easy to think, oh, that owner's being fussy, but I'd want that fussiness being that attention to detail being paid to my own patients. So, if anyone's got any questions, feel free to send them through and I will try to answer them as best as I possibly can do. So, we've just had a couple of questions come through about keeping patients warm under anaesthesia. So, people have kind of mentioned about are the use of heat mats appropriate? The thing I would say about heat mats, and obviously the big concern being heat burns in these patients, is if they are underweight. They are skinnier, they already have that decreased blood supply to that area, they're going to be at much higher risk for me of getting heat, thermal burns under anaesthesia. So it's looking at, can we use alternative heating devices like the burr huggers? Also, what's become available on the market at the moment by a company called Darval is an inspired gas warming device. So basically, it warms the air that that patient is breathing in. That's something I'm going to potentially look at using very soon in the future to see if that's an appropriate way of keeping all patients warm under anaesthesia, particularly those geriatric patients where we really, I want to maybe avoid using thermal burns, and I know thermal burns has been an issue for a lot of people within practice. Other people have asked about using if we do place feeding tubes into these patients, so particularly things like nasogastric tubes, what diets are going to be suitable? I think that's a very difficult one to answer because, first of all, if we place nasogastric tubes, often we're very limited to the type of diets we can get down them, but in our geriatric patients, we want to be a little bit careful because we generally restrict things like phosphate and sodium in them. But some of those critical care diets can have high levels of those. We also want to think about the disease process that's going on. So diabetic patients, patients where refeeding syndromes an issue, maybe we don't want to restrict those things too much. Protein levels can be an issue in that many senior diets have a decrease in protein. So we want to look at how much protein is in these recovery diets. So particularly if you've got patients with renal issues, you know, things like maybe AD or the Royal Canin diets may not be appropriate because of the amount of protein we've got in them. If you do have any major concerns, I would say there are, as far as I know, two diplomats in the UK that hold nutritional qualifications. One is Marge Chandler, and I know she does some work for Vets Now, and the other one is Dan Chan, and I think Marge is based at Edinburgh, but the other one is Dan Chan, who works at the Royal Veterinary College in London. I'm sure they would give you feedback and advice on specific cases that you have in your hospital environment, but just bear that in the back of your mind. You know, a lot of those critical care diets that we're going to get down those feeding tubes may not be appropriate for patients if they have other disease processes. So it doesn't really answer the question, but just kind of saying you may need to look into that further for that specific patient. And that's me done in terms of questions. I'll hand back over to Sammy Joe.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Louise for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.